He just felt that there was nothing he could do about it. Young architects like Robert Weinberg argued among themselves, their park department superiors wouldn't listen to them, that solutions to the difficulties inherent in intensive usage could be compatible with good design. All that was needed, they felt, was imagination and an understanding of the basic needs of the neighborhoods in which the playgrounds were located. Including a bocce court in a playground instead of a row of swings was not, after all, a task requiring immense creativity. Weinberg was particularly incensed at one design defect that reduced the usefulness of many playgrounds and that could have been cured very easily indeed. Some playgrounds were situated atop hills, and their entrances were set with flights of steps, despite the fact that the most frequent users of these parks were mothers with baby carriages, which were difficult to maneuver up steps, and entrance to these playgrounds could have been made easier for them by simply making the entrances ramps instead of steps. But Moses no longer had much time for detail. His imagination was as vigorous as ever. The big projects in which he took a personal interest were innovative, ingenious, daring, and bold, to a considerable extent as carefully thought out in both overall conception and minute details as his Long Island parks. Smaller projects, which happened to fall under his gaze, Carl Schurz Park on the East River at 86th Street, which he passed on his evening walks from his Gracie Terrace apartment, were just as carefully thought out. There are throughout the New York City park system small touches of beauty, comfort stations, for example, that are proof that even a bathroom can bring beauty to a cityscape, but inquiry reveals that most of these structures are the rare ones in which, for one reason or another, Moses took a personal interest. In building his state parks, Moses had been uninterested in building for the lower classes. He was still uninterested, although now he was building parks in the city, where those classes lived. Moses had begun his park commissionership by enthusiastically gobbling up vacant city-owned lots in the slums with the intention of turning them into tiny parks, but this enthusiasm soon waned. The effort involved in creating such vest-pocket parks was immense. The land acquisition alone involved the approval of countless agencies and officials, and therefore endless red tape. Designing something that would make a tiny lot attractive or useful was difficult. Because you couldn't afford to keep a full-time supervisor on duty in every vest-pocket park, those small parks located in slums quickly became filled with rubbish and winos. The rewards involved in creating vest-pocket parks were, moreover, not at all commensurate with the effort required. If the reward was a sense of achievement, what, to the creator of Jones Beach, was the achievement in creating a tiny bit of green space or a few benches or a seesaw or two? Moses had always thought on the grand scale. That was his genius, the ability to grasp the needs of a whole city or state and devise a means of satisfying them. And this quality of mind made it difficult for him to take much interest in something small. There was something inherently good in size itself, he seemed to feel. If the reward was public applause, the size of the reward for building a vest-pocket park was small indeed. Editorial writers didn't get nearly as excited about a tiny park as they did about a Randall's Island or Orchard Beach. It was the great projects that awed them. Size seemed to signify significance to them, too. Whatever the reasons, R.M., an aide would say, just wasn't interested in anything small. He used to say, "That's a little job. Give it to so-and-so." And that attitude filtered down, so that the fellows weren't interested in small things either. Coupled with his feelings about the people for whom the effort would have to be made, the lower classes, who didn't respect or appreciate what was done for them, in particular the Negroes, who were dirty and wouldn't keep his beautiful creations clean, his lack of interest in anything small made him uninterested in small parks in slums. Within a year, the Vest Pocket Park program was all but dead, and he was determined that it wouldn't be revived. He flatly refused a 1936 offer of small, abandoned transportation board plots, calling them of no use to this department because they are all too small. The program never really got off the ground except in two areas, the Irish Catholic slums of the Lower East Side, in which Al Smith, and hence Moses, still took an interest, and LaGuardia's old Little League of Nations, East Harlem Congressional District. In other slum areas, there was almost no park development at all after 1935, and the lack was particularly marked in Negro Harlem and in the South Jamaica and Stuyvesant Heights tenement districts in Queens and Brooklyn, into which a steadily mounting overflow from Harlem had begun to creep. The protests about this policy from the slums themselves were faint and few. Slum dwellers, particularly slum dwellers with black skins, weren't making many protests in the 1930s, but some reformers raised their voices on their behalf. These reformers were in the main those associated with settlement houses. Stanley Isaacs, president of United Neighborhood Houses, was notable among them. Working in the slums, they knew the needs of their people, and knowing, they knew that those people, forced to depend for beauty and recreation on what they could find in their neighborhoods, were particularly desperate for precisely those things that parks provided. Trees, a small plot of grass, a few flowers, anything that would provide a contrast to the concrete and red brick that surrounded the slums' people with bleakness, that trapped them in stone. These people hungered for them. One had to do no more than walk along a block of tenements and look up, and suddenly noticed that fire escapes and windowsills were sprouting rusty cans filled with vines and flowers, to realize that, as one observer was to put it, the poor have every bit as much interest in green growing things as the well-to-do, in open space or natural beauty. Mothers and fathers in the slums hungered for play space for their children. They couldn't afford to send the children to summer camps. They couldn't afford to take them on weekend or vacation trips. Because they didn't have cars, they couldn't take them to the parks Robert Moses had built on Long Island. Because they seldom left the slums, they were only vaguely aware that there were large parks in other sections of the city which the children could reach by subway. Children who went to these parks often returned to say that the white people there had made them feel unwelcome, or that gangs of white teenagers had chased them away, and they did not go again. Any playing that the children of the slums did would have to be done in the slums. Kids have to play. That is what being a kid is. And if there were no parks in the slums for them to play in, they would have to play in the streets. If there were no jungle gyms, they would have to swing on rusty fire escapes. If there were no indoor playhouses in which they could play on rainy days, they would have to find shelter somewhere else, and that meant deserted or burnt-out tenements, the lair of the winos and the junkies and the perverts. And parks meant more in the slums than even beauty or play space. They had other values, more intangible, but also more important. They were assigned to the urban poor, the reformers said, that society cared for them, that the city in which they had been trampled so brutally low was holding out a hand to help them to their feet. In a way, they were a symbol of what Alfred E. Smith, who had understood the urban poor because he was one of them, had been talking about when, fighting for widows' pensions, he had stood in the well of the assembly chamber, a trumpet in his voice, and asked the legislators to consider the penniless widow whose children were taken away from her. What must be her feelings? What must be her idea of the state's policy? What can be the feeling in the hearts of the children themselves when they must in after years learn to know what the state's policy was with respect to their unfortunate condition? What new policy does this bill inaugurate? The state of New York reaches out to them. We recognize in you a resource of the state, and we propose to take care of you, not as a matter of charity, but as a government and public duty. If the city didn't provide parks, the reformers understood, that was a sign that society didn't care. The people who lived in the slums might not verbalize that concept, but they would feel it, even if they didn't put it into words. And therefore, the lack of parks could only increase their bitterness toward society. This last intangible was even more important in terms of the Negroes, whose influx into New York was beginning to assume the proportions of the previous Jewish, Irish, and Italian waves of immigration. There had been only 60,000 Negroes in the city in 1900, but there were 327,706 in 1930, and by 1940 there would be 458,000. The society from which the Negro was alienated was the one that kept the black man confined so low on the economic ladder that in 1939, half of all Negro wage earners in New York were receiving less than $850 per year. It was the society that forced black women to line up every morning in the slave market in the East 160s in the Bronx so that white housewives could bid for their services. The pay was between 10 and 15 cents an hour, with the cost of lunch deducted. It was the society that made sure that Negroes would have to work for such slave wages by closing to them its trade unions, thus adding to their handicap in competing with white men for better jobs, and by denying them the capital necessary to go into business for themselves. There was not a single bank in Harlem north of 125th Street. And as for that embodiment of society that was government, the city government that was supposed to represent them as well as the white man, the attitude of that government was symbolized by public works. When LaGuardia came to office in 1934, there hadn't been a new school built in Harlem in 25 years. LaGuardia's administration didn't get around to building one for four more years. And in all Harlem, the city provided, to serve 300,000 people, exactly one clinic, built with WPA funds in 1937, equipped with substantial facilities for child care, and exactly one hospital, on whose executive staff there was exactly one Negro. Mothers and their babies died in Harlem at a rate more than double that in the city as a whole. More than one out of every 10 babies born in Harlem died at birth. Isaacs and other reformers saw that the swelling Negro population was not being assimilated into the city. Such assimilation was necessary, they said. If the influx continued and there was no base, no solid community that was part of the larger society around it on which it could build, what would happen? The question of what will happen to the Negro in New York is overlaid with shadows of tragic premonition, one wrote. Isaacs and others begged the city to make an intensified effort to meet the needs of these new immigrants. These people needed help, they said, and the city must give it to them. It was a civic duty to do so, they said. It was a matter of conscience. And if you weren't interested in duty or conscience, well, it was a matter of expediency, too. For neglecting Harlem's needs in the future, as they had been neglected in the past, could only lead to havoc in the city. Knowing how important small parks were to the city's poor, the reformers could hardly believe the implications of Moses' policies when they began to discern them. By banning public transportation, he had barred the poor from the state parks. In the same way, he was barring the poor from the best of the city parks, the big parks on the city's outskirts, such as Jacob Riis and Alley Pond. And now he was saying that he would not provide the poor even with small parks. He was pouring tens of millions of dollars into creating new parks in New York, but he was creating almost none for the people who needed parks most. The philosophy that parks were only for the comfortable middle class had been outdated for at least 10 years. But, they began to see, that was the philosophy Moses was following. The reformers were still influential in the city, although they were becoming less so as LaGuardia gathered power unto himself, and, unlike other Moses opponents, they received a hearing for their views from the city's press. Good government organization resolutions calling for small parks in the slums were at least printed, even if primarily on inside pages. But Moses simply shouted the reformers down. He replied, in replies that received better newspaper play than the statements he was replying to, that he was giving the slums parks, great parks. What, he demanded, was the great recreational complex he was building on Randall's Island, the great recreational complex he was building in Riverside Park? They were easily accessible to Harlem. As for small parks within the slums themselves, his experience, he said, had taught him that they were just too expensive to be considered. 3 acres, he said, was the smallest area that could be controlled and managed as a park. And since 3 acres is 130,680 square feet and land bearing profitable slum tenements was going in the 1930s for about $30 per square foot, and a single park would thus cost the city about $4 million for land acquisition costs alone, And since as many as 2,500 people might be displaced by the razing of the tenements involved and would have to be relocated, this was an unanswerable argument, if you accepted it. Many reformers, far more than had ever disagreed with Moses before, did not accept it. A park did not have to be 3 acres to help a slum, they said. It could be the smallest crevice in the grim wall of tenements, even a space the size of a single 100-foot by 20-foot building lot, or smaller, could be planted with grass and a few trees, or, if equipped with a few benches, mean so much to the people of the block on which it was located. Something doesn't have to be big to brighten something that is drab, to bring pride to a place without any pride. Because they have nothing else to do, the people of the slums spend a lot of time looking out their windows. If there was a small park, even a tiny park in the neighborhood, there would be a pleasant little scene to look at, something affirmative. Even if there was no grass in the park, there could be a few benches, and all at once the neighborhood would have a better place to rest than the fenders of parked cars. A best pocket park could be an elegant little plaza, but it could also be just a place for a kid to play or the elderly to relax, or for a pregnant mother to sit down for a minute on a walk home from the grocery store that suddenly seemed longer than it ever had before. The reformers, experts in parks, knew there were good small parks in other cities. They knew that Moses' argument was wrong. Furthermore, these reformers said, Randall's Island and Riverside Park were not easily accessible to the slums. The Triborough Bridge would make the island accessible by car, but the people of the slums didn't have cars. There would, by Moses' edict, be no bus service to the island. The only way to get there would be to walk, from the nearest point in Harlem or the South Bronx, a good 3/4 of a mile. And that was from the nearest point of the slums, the edge on the river. From most of the slums, you would have to walk much farther. From the center of Harlem, then 145th Street, say, more than 2 miles. Riverside Park along the Hudson River was a hike up a long, achingly steep hill from the nearest point in Harlem. People didn't want to hike long distances to parks. They wanted recreational facilities close at hand, so that every trip to sit under a tree or shoot some baskets didn't have to be an expedition. The people of the slums wouldn't use these parks, they said. Morningside, St. Nicholas, and Colonial Parks, the 3 parks which formed the western border of Harlem, were fine, they said, but there was no other park between them and the East River. In the entire 3 square miles of Harlem, an area which contained 300,000 people, there wasn't a single patch of green. But while newspapers printed the reformers' resolutions, they did not support them editorially, and the reform front on the issue was not solid. The prestigious Park Association of New York City was dominated by elderly park fighters who clung to the old view of parks. Its insistence that Central Park be kept for passive contemplation was the proof of the way it really felt. And while its president, Mrs. Sulzberger, was more liberal on the point than many of her colleagues, Mrs. Sulzberger was not criticizing Robert Moses. And Moses was not listening to criticism anyway. When an alderman from Harlem wrote to Moses appealing for more playgrounds, Moses replied that he was, of course, in entire sympathy with what you have in mind, but that the sites you suggest are too expensive. We shall provide 1 playground in Harlem. When the alderman ventured to write him again on the subject, Moses declined to continue the correspondence. In 1930, Moses, as head of the Metropolitan Park Conference, had led the fight to persuade the city to preserve parts of its fast-disappearing woodland in Queens and Staten Island by purchasing huge tracts for parkland. Reformers had cheered him for that accomplishment. It had preserved open space, beautiful, wooded open space, for the city forever. But now Moses was filling that space with baseball diamonds and football fields and tennis courts, and the land for them could be cleared only by cutting down trees. And Moses was filling other parks with playgrounds and stadia and parking fields and handball courts. Throughout the city's park system, the reformers suddenly realized, grass was giving way to concrete. The reformers knew that grass had to be supplanted by recreational facilities and parking lots in many of the city's parks, but not, they were sure, in all the city's parks. But Moses' plans for parks did not include keeping them, any of them, in their natural state. His plans were not limited to repairing the ravages made in them by Tammany Park commissioners so as to restore them to their natural state. His plans were to cram them, cram all of them, with bathhouses and tennis houses, baseball diamonds and tennis courts, restaurants and bicycle paths, zoos and asphalted playgrounds with ugly black iron fences around them, as well as with that essence of the city, concrete. The concrete of access roads, through roads, and parking lots. Concrete instead of precious grass. It took a while for the reformers to realize what Moses was doing. First, because he kept his plans so secret that it was difficult for them to discern the overall pattern beneath them until they had begun unfolding. Second, because they had been so thoroughly convinced that he was a fighter for parks that they did not easily accept the realization that his definition of parks was much narrower than theirs, and perhaps not at all compatible with it, that where they saw in a towering stand of oak and elms and white pine a priceless bounty to a beauty-starved city, Moses saw a baseball diamond. Many of them, in fact, never came during the 1930s to realize this, because they never took the time to study his overall park plans, and while they were distressed by what he was doing to a particular park in which they were interested, they accepted his assurances that he was preserving nature in the rest of the park system. But some of the reformers did come to realize the implications of Moses' park philosophy rather quickly, and were anxious to discuss it with him. They were anxious that room be found in the park system, which, after all, was a huge one and included thousands of acres of still undeveloped woods and fields and streams, for their values as well as his. They were sure that in a discussion they would have no difficulty explaining to him, for they all agreed he was brilliant, the most brilliant public servant, many of them said, that they had ever met, the crucial difference, which apparently he had not yet grasped, between the implications of his philosophy when applied to Long Island parks and parks within the city. On no point, in fact, were they more anxious for discussion, for the destruction of the natural values of a park was not a remediable mistake. It was one that could never be rectified. Destroy the delicate natural balance of a marshland to make a concrete-lined lagoon, and it did not lie with the power of man to restore that balance. Before any changes were made in the parks, therefore, there must be sufficient discussion to ensure that the changes made were the right ones. But Moses no longer had to discuss. He had long had great dreams for the city, and now he had learned how to make dreams come true. He had learned the technique of stake driving and of whipsawing. He had learned how to mislead and conceal and deceive, how to lie to men and bully them, how to ruin their reputations. And he used all these methods to bring the dream to reality. Or was it all for the dream?
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.
This is Audible.
The Power Broker. Robert Moses and the Fall of New York. By Robert Caro. Part 5. The Love of Power. Chapter 25. Changing. Because of the arrogance that was so basic to his nature, and to his mother's and grandmother's, Moses' susceptibility to the addiction of power was unusually strong. After he was given substantial power of his own by his appointment in 1924 to the presidency of the Long Island State Park Commission, the doses available to him were massive, but they did not satisfy him, as was noted by Judge Clearwater and Ansley Wilcox, who, charting his symptoms, observed, "A sense of dominating authority and a desire to have his own way in all matters, large and small." Once Robert Moses had sought power only for the sake of his dreams, only as a means to an end. Even then, however, there were signs that he was beginning to seek it for its own sake, as an end in itself. And the avidity with which he sought power, and the lengths to which he went to get it, revealed the depth of his need for it. The need was strong, and it was growing. And now it had been growing for 10 years. Power is being able to laugh at people who oppose you, and to laugh at them with impunity, to antagonize them without fear of reprisal. Now Robert Moses seemed to be going out of his way to laugh at people. The community councils of the City of New York, Inc., and their executive secretary, Minister Frank P. Beale, were disturbed by his plan to raise a reproduction of George Washington's Mount Vernon in Prospect Park, but they were not pressing the point particularly hard or attempting to make a large public issue of it. The councils had no power. Moses could easily have ignored them and simply have gone ahead with the work. Instead, he gave the opposition publicity, calling in reporters to tell them about it, apparently for no other reason than to be able to tell them that the work is going ahead in spite of the community council, and so that he could deliver himself of a remark that he wanted to make and have published. He set up the remark by saying, "It's a strange thing, but nothing has been heard from any responsible person on the community council." A reporter asked, as Moses had undoubtedly expected a reporter to ask, "What about Mr. Beale?" And Moses could thereupon say, "That's what I mean." On other occasions, he similarly volunteered information about opposition, only so that he could loftily dismiss it. Once he volunteered, unsolicited, the information that a group of distinguished architects had presented him with a plan for reconstruction of Bryant Park, apparently just so that he could add, with a smile, "Such a plan is not to be carried out." He seemed to be going out of his way to antagonize people. He could have simply ignored William Exton and Robert Weinberg when they began proposing changes in his West Side Improvement Plan. The two young reformers had no chance of making him even consider the changes. But he agreed to the interview with Exton, and Exton recalls that when he arrived at Moses' office, he said, "Well, as City Park Commissioner, maybe I can see you have a case, but the State Park Commission says so-and-so, and the authority says so-and-so." Well, he was the State Park Commission, and he was the authority, and I knew it, and he knew I knew it. It wasn't particularly subtle. It was just thumbing his nose at you. And, Exton says, he had the feeling that Moses had given him the interview just so he could have the pleasure of thumbing it. Once he apparently went all the way to the Rockaways just to antagonize a local civic association which had invited him to speak because they were concerned about the effect his proposed Marine Parkway Bridge might have on Floyd Bennett Field, the airport that was the Rockaways' pride. He could have declined the invitation. He seldom spoke before civic groups, but he accepted and made the long trip across Jamaica Bay, mounted the stage, and informed the audience, "That airport of yours isn't so hot. It never should have been built in the first place." And then, as the Times reported, he smacked his hand down and glanced up at the ceiling to indicate that he was through discussing the topic. If Moses had any motive for the trip, to enlighten the audience, educate them, persuade them, convince them, conciliate them, listen to them, or answer their questions, other than his enjoyment at insulting them and showing them that he could thumb his nose in their faces and there was nothing they could do about it, that motive eluded the audience. Power is being able to ruin people, to ruin their careers and their reputations and their personal relationships. Moses had this power, and he seemed to use it even when there was no need to, going out of his way to use it, so that it is difficult to escape the conclusion that he enjoyed using it. He may have felt it was necessary to turn the power of his vituperation on men whom he felt posed a threat to his dreams, but he turned it also on individuals who posed no such threat. Pearl Bernstein, for example, was a young Barnard College graduate whom LaGuardia, for some inexplicable reason, had had appointed secretary to the Board of Estimate. She was a naive girl, and the job was utterly beyond her, Kern recalls. It was common knowledge that she made no decisions on her own, but simply carried out LaGuardia's orders, relayed through Kern. Moses must have known this, but when, in 1934, LaGuardia, infuriated by the park commissioner's cooperation with Democratic members of the board, issued an order that no matter was to be placed on its calendar at the instance of any commissioner until he had personally approved it, and Miss Bernstein, who was in charge of the calendar, therefore refused to place on it some of Moses' unapproved requests, Moses attacked her, writing Kern a letter, with copies sent simultaneously to Miss Bernstein's associates and to officials throughout City Hall, attacking her amateurishness, delay, and pettiness, and complete absence of willingness to cooperate with people who are trying to get something accomplished. Kern, who was at this point still a Moses fanatic, was startled because he knew that the mayor, not Miss Bernstein, was the source of the order. Kern had, in fact, heard Moses arguing with LaGuardia about it. Just in case the park commissioner had forgotten, Kern reminded him of this fact. But to his surprise, the attacks continued, escalating in viciousness. One, also circulated throughout City Hall, referred to the order as one of Pearl Bernstein's new wrinkles, and added, "If it were merely a question of casting swine before Pearl, I should be glad to have a standing order at any slaughterhouse, but these are really important construction matters with which she is interfering." Kern began to realize, reluctantly, that his idol, angry at the order and unwilling to argue further with its originator, had decided to vent his spleen on Miss Bernstein instead, apparently for no other reason than that she was handy and too small to fight back. Moses' attacks, Kern was to conclude, were an example of his irresponsible brutality, a wantonness almost, a sadistic joy in hurting other people, as well as of his willingness to beat little people on occasions when he was reluctant to go to the mat with big people, like the mayor. The number of defenseless minor officials on whom Moses unleashed his vituperation was legion. The officials least able to fight back were those on his own staff, and to those he was, if possible, even more viciously abusive. Once, when one of his aides, at a luncheon meeting attended by a dozen men, ventured to offer a suggestion which he hadn't cleared with Moses first, Moses whirled on him and said, "Now you're just a swabby on this ship. Do you understand?" And while the others present squirmed in embarrassment for the man being humiliated, Moses repeated to him, "Do you understand? Do you understand?" Refusing to be satisfied with a nod, making the aide say out loud, "Yes, sir." And the bullying was not just verbal. City Hall was whispering about Moses' physical encounters with other men. The 200-pound park commissioner had had at least two such encounters during his governmental career prior to entering the city administration, and, as in the case of scrawny little Slat Johnson, the roommate he knocked down at Yale, neither of them was his physical equal. Raymond Torrey, whom he tried to strangle at a State Council of Parks meeting, and at whom he then hurled a heavy smoking stand, was a pudgy little bird watcher. Moses had also staged a fist fight with WPA Administrator Hugh Johnson in Bernard Baruch's apartment, and Johnson, at the time, was 52, 8 years older than Moses, and exceedingly drunk. Now Moses had additional physical encounters, and the pattern continued. This was at the opening of a section of the West Side Highway, Joseph Ingraham of the Times recalls. "It was raining, and we had to go into some kind of tent. Some little old character, just a minor functionary in government, was there, and Moses said to me, 'Wait till you see what I do to this guy.' He went over and grabbed him, and almost literally picked him up by the scruff of the neck and shook him. It was very embarrassing. I said, 'What did he do?' He said, 'He hasn't done anything yet, but I just wanted to head him off.'" Other City Hall observers recall other Moses fist fights, but not one with a man to whom he had a chance of losing. Once, in an executive session of the Board of Estimate, Moses presented the board with a proposal for a project whose cost, he promised, would be borne almost entirely by the federal government and would cost the city practically nothing. He presented the board with a set of extremely detailed facts to prove his point. Most of the members of the board were thinking the same thing, one of them recalls, but only Stanley Isaacs had the courage to give the thought's voice. He said mildly, "When Mr. Moses says something will cost 3.4%, he adds the 0.4 only to make you think it's accurate. It's really 6.2%. Moses' response was to take a violent swing with his fist in Isaac's direction and say, "I'd like to punch you in the nose." "He wasn't close enough to hit him with a baseball bat," says Isaac's Borough Works Commissioner, Walter D. Binger. "It was just a motion of passion, but Moses was tall and athletic, and the mild-mannered Isaacs was 57 years old. Everyone in the room was shocked," Binger says. He wasn't satisfied merely to defeat people who opposed his wishes. He had to try to destroy them, too. He wasn't content with ignoring Exton and Weinberg, and he wasn't content with thumbing his nose at them either. He had to attempt to damage their reputations beyond repair by charging, falsely, that the two young reformers wanted the location of the Henry Hudson Bridge changed because a change would increase the value of Weinberg's property. For years, he had been stung by the caustic voice of the old judge, James B. Cooper, whose Babylon leader continued to remind the residents of Moses' summer hometown that Moses had broken his promise never to charge tolls on the Wantagh Causeway, and who in the 1930s was leading the opposition to Moses' proposal to build a highway on Fire Island, although, with scrupulous fairness, he always allowed plenty of room in the leader for Moses' replies. Now, Moses did everything he could to silence that voice. "We had always carried legals, the advertising of contracts and new ordinances, for example, that governmental bodies are required by law to do in newspapers, and that is often the difference between profit and loss for small-town weeklies, from the state," recalls Cooper's son. "And then they just suddenly disappeared from the paper. He had some, and then he had none. They never said anything directly. They'd be far too subtle for that." The leader was simply no longer included on the list of Suffolk County publications which shared in the legal advertising connected with state projects which were located in Suffolk and had to be advertised in that county. Says Cooper's son, "I grew up in a house where we knew that we weren't going to get any printing from the state because of the way my father fought editorially for what he believed in." There were hints from Long Island State Park Commission executives that Cooper could get the legals back, and lucrative state printing contracts besides. "The inference was, behave yourself and you'll be taken care of," the son says, "but that sort of thing never appealed to my father. He had on his masthead, 'I have never known a master, and I've never worn a muzzle,' and he would rather be broke than lose his soul." Soon, he was broke. The legals had been very important in the touch-and-go financing of the little newspaper. Its circulation never reached 4,000 during Judge Cooper's 30 years as publisher, and the paper almost died before he did, on May 30, 1940. "But what mattered more than the money involved in the legals," his widow says, "was the principle of the thing. His feelings were hurt that anyone would do such a thing." A streak of maliciousness and spitefulness seemed to run through Moses' character, and he gave that full play, too. The sole oasis in muddy and barren Riverside Park was the Columbia Yacht Club, which, since 1888, had been occupying an acre at the foot of 86th Street, paying only a nominal rent of $300 per year because it had created most of the acre itself by barging in landfill, had spent $50,000 building its own marina and three-story clubhouse, and because it maintained those buildings and surrounding lawns, hedges, and flower beds it had planted at its own expense. The club's 600 members had succeeded in making themselves semi-official city hosts to visiting royalty. The club's proudest boast was that the Prince of Wales had made it his headquarters on not one but two visits aboard the Renown, and club members seemed to regard themselves as the city's link with maritime glory. Naval officers of all nations were always welcome, and the club was an official host for the squadrons of the U.S. Navy, which anchored off Manhattan each summer. In March 1934, 3 months after he had been sworn in as City Park Commissioner, Moses announced that the Columbia Yacht Club was in the way of his West Side improvement and would be torn down. Shocked as the members were, they didn't try to fight the eviction. They understood that the park belonged to the city. Their only request was that they be allowed to remain in the clubhouse through September, so they could fulfill their pledge to entertain the U.S. Navy's Pacific Fleet, which was arriving in July for the summer. At first, Moses agreed to this request without reservation. He certainly had no reason not to, for there was no prospect that work on the improvement would have progressed far enough by September so that the presence of a single building in the 6 miles of park would interfere with it. In March 1934, he wasn't even sure where the Henry Hudson Parkway was going to run. No plans had yet been drawn for any substantial part of it, and money for the job was not yet in hand, or indeed in sight. But then Moses saw an opportunity of obtaining a valuable addition to the improvement for nothing. He evidently decided to turn the clubhouse into a public restaurant on the waterfront, and he sent Ray McNulty back to the club officials with the message that he would allow the club to remain through September only if it then donated its clubhouse and marina to the Park Department. On April 18th, Club Commodore John A. Harless telephoned Moses to tell him that the board was agreeable and wanted only enough time to submit the proposition to the entire membership, which he expected would also approve it. Unfortunately, in talking to Moses, Harris somehow, he was never to be sure how, managed to irritate him. The next day, the Commodore received a letter from the Commissioner, a letter he later characterized as brutal, accusing the club of stalling, ordering it to vacate its site by May 1st, in exactly 12 days, and warning that, if your property is not removed by that date, it will be treated as abandoned property and confiscated. Anticipating that the matter would become public knowledge, Moses went to the press, and he did so with his usual blend of demagoguery and deception, breaking the story himself to get his side of it before the public first, oversimplifying the basic issue to one of public versus private interest, identifying the private interests with the sinister forces of influence and privilege, concealing any facts that might damage his own image. "The whole question," he said, "is whether public interest is going to yield to private, whether parks are going to be for the people." The public needed the land occupied by the yacht club, and it needed it immediately, so that a great public improvement could be gotten underway, he said. He had advanced the date of eviction because the West Side improvement was progressing faster than he had thought it would, and any delay in evicting the yacht club would slow the improvement down. Moreover, the use of the public's property by the club was a social racket, an exclusive privilege, successful in the past only because of the influence of certain members. The club had not the slightest legal right to be on the property in the first place. "It has," he stated flatly, "no lease, no permit, no anything." He did not neglect to add a touch of class antagonism. "It is an interesting fact," he said, "that the yacht club, in their talk of entertaining yachtsmen and officers, say nothing about the entertainment of enlisted men." The tactics worked as successfully as usual. The headline on the Times article reporting one of his press releases was, "Parks come first," Moses declares, while the Herald Tribune headlined, "Columbia Yacht Club is racket," Moses repeats. The club applied to the state Supreme Court for a temporary injunction restraining Moses from ousting it so quickly. And in that more impartial arena, there emerged, as usual, some facts that Moses had somehow neglected to mention. The park commissioner had contended that the club had no lease, no permit, no anything for the use of the parkland. The attorney for the club said that the club had had a permit since 1888, that the permit had been renewed by the Park Department annually each of the 46 years since, including 1934, and that Moses knew it. And to prove his contentions, the attorney presented the court with a photostat of a check for $150 for the first half of the 1934 rent, made out to and deposited and accepted by the Park Department. Moses had also contended that the club had never done anything but occupy the public's property. Obviously, the attorney pointed out, the club had done far more. It had improved the public's property, building $50,000 worth of structures on it. And now it was probably willing to give all those improvements to the public in return for only 5 more months of occupancy. The Board of Trustees was agreeable to such an arrangement. It was asking only for enough time to poll the membership. Moreover, even if the schedule for the West Side improvement required the club to vacate in a hurry, its members, some of whom were in Europe, should be given more than 12 days to remove their property from the clubhouse or have it confiscated as abandoned. And the schedule did not require the club to vacate in a hurry. It was quite obvious that the improvement was barely underway, and that even if money was made available, Moses had more than 6 miles of Riverside Park to work in and did not have to start immediately on the single acre that the club occupied. Supreme Court Justice Aaron J. Levy found the attorney's statements accurate, noting dryly in the opinion he handed down that the commissioner was in error in asserting that the club was occupying the premises without a permit. And the judge went further. Even if Moses' motives were honorable, he said, he had allowed himself to be carried away. I must observe that a burning zeal for the public interest should not dazzle a public official, no matter how well-intentioned, so as to blind him to individual amenities. Even where the public authority is entirely correct in his legal position, he should maintain it without inflicting undue hardship or injury. Tyranny, whether it consists of oppressive measures or brutal severity, is never necessary. And, the justice said, he was not at all sure Moses' motives were honorable. His examination of the commissioner's plans for the West Side improvement left no doubt that the club's land would not be needed that summer at all. The precipitate notice gives the appearance of having been prompted by the commissioner's pique at plaintiff's refusal to accept his terms. He issued a temporary injunction, restraining Moses from ousting the club until a trial on the matter could be held. But Moses was not to be restrained by a judge. Even as the club's attorney had been applying for the temporary injunction, 2 huge steam shovels were rumbling into Riverside Park and taking up positions north and south of the clubhouse. As club members watched in amazement, they began scooping out trenches all the way from the New York Central Railroad tracks in the middle of the park to the edge of the river. Their operators said they were testing the fill, but the yacht clubbers realized with a shock that once the trenches were completed, the dirt roads from north and south would be cut. There would be no way for members' automobiles or delivery trucks to reach the clubhouse, and the only means of access by foot would be along a narrow footbridge across the railroad tracks. Shouting to make himself heard above the thunderous chug-chug of the shovels, a club official told a reporter he had called to the scene, "They will have us dug out of here before the court can render its decision." This occurred on a Friday. The next day, with the clubhouse crowded with men and women preparing for some weekend yachting or sipping drinks in the pleasantly shadowy clubhouse bar, the shadows suddenly grew deeper. The club's electricity had been turned off. Hurriedly telephoning the New York Consolidated Edison Company to find out what had happened, the club superintendent was informed by an official there that someone from the club had asked that the current be shut off. The superintendent said he was sure there had been some mistake, and when the Con Ed officials checked, he found out that there had indeed. The man who had identified himself as being from the club was actually from the park department. As the club's electricity was being turned on, its water was almost being turned off. 10 men drove up in a park department automobile and began digging near the clubhouse. When the club superintendent demanded to know what they were doing, they said they wanted to repair a leak in the water main. Only their inability to locate the main kept the club liquid. Sheer spite work, the club secretary termed Moses' actions, but reporters who telephoned the commissioner found him unabashed. As the Herald Tribune put it, "Mr. Moses said he knew nothing of this, but that it might easily be true. I instructed my men," he said, "to go ahead with the construction work for the improvement of that part of the park, and not to let anything get in the way. It is perfectly possible they did this." Some of the city's elected officials attempted to restrain him, the Board of Aldermen passing a resolution demanding that Moses rescind his eviction order. One of the aldermen, fusionist Lambert Fairchild, called the park commissioner's methods steam shovel government. But Moses was not to be restrained by elected officials. The board's action, he said, was just cheap politics. I don't take their actions seriously. I'm sure they didn't. He filled the press with his side of the story. The whole question is whether private interest should yield to public interest. And if the press saw that some other questions were involved, it didn't mention them. And by the time the temporary injunction halted his steam shovels, they had completed the trench to the north of the clubhouse, cutting off all access from that direction, and had completed all of the trench to the south except for a narrow gap described as perilously close to the river, and as a final touch, Moses had stationed a guard at the gap to charge all vehicles using it a quarter toll. Club members felt that their continued occupancy of a clubhouse that seemed to be under siege was untenable, and that they might as well stop fighting. In a stipulation entered into before the trial for a permanent injunction, they agreed to get out if Moses would just give them enough time to remove their property, until June 18th. When the fleet docked in July, they were not there to welcome it. And neither was their clubhouse. Moses had razed it to the ground, as he had the Central Park Casino, the physical structure on which he had vented his malevolence against Jimmy Walker. By destroying the Columbia Yacht Clubhouse, he deprived the city of a $50,000 structure which could have been turned into a waterfront restaurant with only the most minor alterations, or, if he didn't want to leave it on the waterfront, could have been moved to any other park in the city and used for any purpose he chose. And while Moses had maintained that he had harried the club out of existence so mercilessly because its existence conflicted with the public interest, those close to the affair knew differently, knew that his actions were, as the club secretary had said, sheer spite work. Recalls Assistant Corporation Counsel Chandler, who handled the case for Moses and drew up the final stipulation, "I spoke to Moses about it. He said they had to be evicted at once. I said, why? He said, because they were rude to me." If Moses was indulging his enjoyment at hurting people not in order to help him with his aims, but simply because he liked hurting, the indulgence nonetheless helped him achieve his aims. As Judge Jacob Lutsky puts it, "If you know that every time you get in a guy's way, he's going to kick you in the balls, you make pretty damn sure you don't get in his way, right?" Within a remarkably brief time after Moses entered the city administration, word had spread through City Hall and the municipal building that any time someone got in Moses' way, Moses kicked him in the balls. So the men who worked in those two buildings were in general exceedingly careful not to get in his way. They went to great lengths to do exactly what he wanted, when he wanted. The great spongy mass of the city's bureaucracy, a mass of inertia and red tape and obfuscation and confusion, had absorbed and smothered the energy and the dreams of 1,000 commissioners. But Commissioner Robert Moses sliced through the bureaucracy as if it were soft butter and he were a knife. And when at public meetings of the Board of Estimate, he would stride up to the little lectern reserved for city officials appearing before the board and extend his hand behind him without looking, like a surgeon extending his hand for a scalpel, and an aide smacked a file folder into the hand, and Moses opened it and began, with the precision of a great surgeon, to dissect a man's character. The members of the board, watching the reporter's pens and pencils avidly scribbling down his words, knew that those words would be appearing in headlines. "He was terribly unfair to people," McGoldrick says. But, the comptroller admits, the attacks served their purpose. Moses' methods did intimidate people from debating with him. And it intimidated us, too, most likely. Soon, in the whole city government, from bureaucracy to Board of Estimate to mayor, there was no one to stand in the way of his dream, no one who would dare to tell the public the truth about the methods that were being used to make it come true, no one who would venture to examine or to proclaim its flaws. And the dream unrolled. During the 1930s, Robert Moses reshaped the face of the greatest city in the New World. He gouged great gashes across it, gashes that once had contained houses by the hundreds and apartment houses by the score. He laid great swaths of concrete across it. He made it grayer, not only with his highways, but with parking fields, like the one on Randall's Island that held 4,000 cars, the one at Orchard Beach that held 8,000, and the one at Jacob Riis Park that held 9,000, that together covered with asphalt a full square mile of the 319 in the city. And he made it greener, planting within its borders 2.5 million trees, shrubs, and vines, bringing 1 million others back to bloom, reseeding lawns whose area totaled 4 square miles and creating a full square mile more of new ones. He filled in its marshes and made them parks. He yanked railroad trestles off its avenues, clearing an even dozen from Brooklyn's Atlantic Avenue alone as part of a grade crossing elimination program he considered so minor that he seldom mentioned it. He brought the stars down to it, arranging, in a brief interval crammed in between more important projects, for the financing of Hayden Planetarium. He changed its very shape. The millions of cubic feet of rock and shale and sand and stone that the long convoys of his barges and the endless caravans of his trucks dumped behind the steel bulkheads that he rammed out away from its shoreline into the muck beneath rivers and harbors hardened into new land, more than 5,000 acres of new land, and thus expanded and transformed its physical contours, adding to Manhattan Island alone an area as large as the island from river to river between 59th and 86th Streets. He joined together small islands within its borders with Earth, blending Ward's Island into Randall's and Hunter's and Twin Islands into Rodman Neck. He soldered together the larger islands that were its boroughs with steel, linking 3 of them together at once with the Triborough Bridge, tying the West Bronx to Manhattan with the Henry Hudson, drawing the far-flung Rockaways closer to the rest of Metropolis with the Marine Parkway span. In the 5 years after he became park commissioner, in a city in which the parks had been barren for decades, he made the parks bloom. In a city in which there had been only 119 playgrounds, he built 255 new ones. In a city in which not a mile of new arterial highway had been built in 15 years, he built 50 miles of arterial highway. In a city in which a new bridge had not been built in a quarter of a century, he built not only the 3 new big bridges, Triborough, Henry Hudson, and Marine Parkway, but 110 smaller ones to carry local streets across his parkways. Si monumentum requiris, circumspice, reads the inscription on the tomb of Sir Christopher Wren. If you would see his monument, look around. By 1939, the same advice could have been given to a New Yorker asking to see the monuments of Robert Moses. They were everywhere in the great city. With his showman's flair for the spectacular, Moses made the opening of each of his creations an event, a colorful civic celebration, and if the celebrations sometimes seemed more like morality plays, for Moses was careful to point out at each one that the creation had been possible because of the victory of the altruistic public servant over old hack Tammany politicians and red tape bureaucrats, the public was so enthusiastic that it didn't mind the moralizing. New York City cheered what Robert Moses was doing to it. Cheered so loudly, in fact, that the thin cries of disagreement and despair, were all but completely drowned out. Robert Moses built 255 neighborhood playgrounds in New York City during the 1930s. The adults and children who attended playground dedication ceremonies cheered when, at the end of the speeches, the fountain showers in the wading pools were turned on, and the cheers were echoed and amplified by the press. "Nothing Robert Moses has done is as great as what he has done with playgrounds," the World Telegram said. "He has bestowed an unqualified boon on the neighborhoods of this city." To dramatize the size of the achievement, Moses gave each playground a number, and the press counted along with him. "Playground number 189 opens," the headline said. "Playground number 194 dedicated. Playground 204. Playground 240. And he had his mapmakers prepare pairs of outline maps of the city, blank except for dots representing playgrounds. The map on the left would be labeled simply 1933, the year before he had become park commissioner, the one on the right simply 1937, or 1938 or 1939. And the contrast between the two maps was certainly spectacular, the one on the left almost empty, the one on the right covered thickly with dots. And public and press drew from the maps the conclusion that Moses wanted drawn from them, that his playground building program was an unqualified improvement, an absolutely unalloyed benefit to all the people of New York City. A close inspection of the maps would have revealed some rather puzzling characteristics.